be forever? Or is my mind just rambling on? I touched you once, I kissed you once, now I feel like you're mine. Well, I feel like you're mine, and seeing your face, I'm not wrong to have these feelings. Well, I feel like you're mine, I've never known a time before that's had so many meanings. Could it be forever?
Could It Be Forever by the singer who, by the time he was 21, had a fan club larger than the Beatles and the Rolling Stones put together and was the highest paid solo artist in the world. That was 30 years ago, believe it or not. So let's catch up now. That teen idol is with me in the studio, David Cassidy. And David, it's great to see you again.
Great to talk to you too. I can't believe it. 30 years ago. My Lord.
Well, what times we had, didn't we? I'm not sure that you enjoyed all of it, did you, really?
Well, not all of it. I have to say it's wonderful to be, you know, successful and to have people care about you. But when they care to the extent of where they're tearing your clothes off and they're, you know, ripping your car apart. And it yeah, I mean, you were there. Remember that when I played Wembley, I broke the Rolling Stones record for six consecutive sellouts there at Wembley in London. And I remember you introduced me.
I did. Give me a D. Give me an A.
That's right. You know, I heard it's on the Cassidy Live album, and it was on those albums, thank God. I still call them albums. I've got a new one out, and I still call it an album. But it's on the live album, and the beginning of it, and people thought, well, that can't actually be real. I've had people say to me, I heard this album. You must have gone and gotten, like, other people screaming or something. That couldn't have possibly been real or for you. And it was an amazing time for me. It was losing your own personal identity, I think, for me was the most difficult part. But having people love you and care about you just maybe a little too much. Having them care about the music, which they still do, thank God, is the reason I still do it and that I'm coming back over here in April to tour.
Well, let's go back, David, to the start of the story, because, of course, it began with the Partridge Family in 1970. There you were, two brothers, two sisters, and your mum, who in the first episode helps you all to make a record in the garage. And, of course, that record became an enormous hit both in the story and in real life.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. In America, the single, I Think I Love You, it took months to break. We recorded it, I think, in February or March. And I was out on a promotion tour during the summer. And it took, probably about 12 to 15 weeks for it to really break. By the time the show aired in September in the United States, the single, I Think I Love You, was top 10. And by the time the airing of the show, it went to number one, and it stayed number one for a number of weeks and was, in fact, the biggest-selling single of the year. ironically, because I grew up with the Beatles, as you know, and being a teenager and got an electric guitar after seeing them on the Ed Sullivan Show in America. The next day I went out, I was 13, and I learned to play. It was ironic that it was the Beatles' last single was Let It Be. And it just is very odd, because I remember it was a bigger selling single than Let It Be, and I thought, oh, my God. Anyway.
Well, were you surprised? I mean, when you did the TV series, were you surprised that it was such an enormous success?
I can't say I was. Well, you never go into anything thinking it's going to be an enormous failure. Mm. I thought it was good for what it was, and I thought the music was, well, the first couple of things that we cut. I had never made a record before. I was an actor, and even though I'd been playing in garage bands and playing guitar and all that, I wasn't doing it professionally. But when I got to work in the studio with all the amazing musicians from Hal Blaine and Larry Nechtel and Larry Carlton, Louis Shelton, Mike Melvoin, Bobby Hall, I mean, all these great, great, great legendary players. Mm. I knew that we were on something, because they were like, wow, this is really good. And they had no musical prejudice. They knew what was a hit and what wasn't. And then, you know, the success of the single, and I was on the cover of all of these magazines. I can't say I was shocked that it became such an enormous hit, but you're never prepared for that kind of fame. I mean, for them suddenly to make, you know, David Cassidy dolls, dresses, lunchboxes, bubblegum cards, and, you know, the rest of it, pillowcases. I think it was, you know, it wasn't expected by any means, but I was understanding that this was what it was like to get on that kind of a roll. I was really pleased that people responded as positively to the show and to the music as they had, because I thought it was, for pop music, even though it wasn't a reflection of my own musical taste necessarily, I thought it was great.
Now, the producers initially were worried about casting you for the show, because you were working with your stepmother, Shirley Jones.
Well, that's sort of not true. There's been a number of stories. I had been working in television and the year before, and had gotten pretty hot as an actor. I'd done like 10 leads and guest shots. They didn't actually know. When we showed up for the final screen test, I didn't know Shirley had gotten the part. She'd only gotten cast the night before. And we actually did real screen tests on the soundstage in those days. And they were down to two groups, two actors for each role. And I walked up to her. I looked at her. I remember seeing her there in the morning. And I said, what are you doing here? And she said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm auditioning for the role. And she said, well, I got cast as the mother last night. Oh, no. It was one of those. Shall we tell them? Mm. No, she said, no. Unless they've said anything now, let's not say a thing. She said, I'm worried if they find out, they might think, uh-oh, I'm your stepmother. Therefore, there might be some bad blood or anything. Mm. So after the screen test was done, she had a conversation with the producers and said, look, David's my, you know, Jack's son, and I love him. He's wonderful. And if you think he's right, then fine. If not, you know, no harm, no foul. But it was great, and it worked. And the chemistry between all of us on the television show, on the Partridge Family, was great. Danny and Susan Day and Dave Madden, who played Reuben Kincaid, all of them. And I still see, except for the little boys, I still see just about all of them, except Susan Day. I talked to Danny. He's on the radio. He does what you do, in fact, David, in America, and he's quite successful. I don't know anyone that's seen Susan Day for the last 10 years or so. But I see Shirley, Babe Madden. I've been touring around the U.S. doing concerts, and they come and see me whenever I'm playing around their area.
Well, Shirley, of course, did the backing vocals on the record. I think we should hear it now, The Partridge Family and I Think I Love You.
In the middle of a good dream, like all at once I wake up from something that keeps knocking at my brain. Before I go insane, I hold my pillow to my head and spring
up in my bed, screaming out the words I dread. I think I love you.
I think I love you.
This morning I woke up with this feeling I didn't know how to deal with, and so I just decided to myself I'd hide it to myself and never talk about it, and did not go and shout it when you walked into the room. I think I love you.
Up against, I don't know what it's all about. I got so much to think about.
Hey, I think I love you. So what am I so afraid of? I'm afraid that I'm not sure of a love there is no cure for. I think I love you. Isn't that what life is made of? Though it worries me to say I never felt this way.
You really don't have to worry. I only wanna make you happy. And if you say, hey, go away, I will. But I think better still, I'd better stay around and love you. Do you think I have a case? Let me ask you to your face. Do you think you love me?
I think I love you. I think I love you.
I think I love you.
I think I love you.
I think I love you.
Well, that was the Partridge Family and I Think I Love You, the song that catapulted David Cassidy to fame, topping the American charts for 3 weeks and eventually selling a phenomenal 5 million copies. Now, let's talk about your own parents, because, David, you were born into an acting family living in New York. Did you ever think you would do anything else apart from go into what we loosely called show business?
No, actually, I didn't. From the time I saw my dad on stage, when I was 3 years old, I saw him in a show called Wish You Were Here. We lived in New York, and I remember my mom and I took a cab, and we were sitting in the back of a cab. I can remember the excitement I felt after I saw my dad on the stage and said, I want to do that. And both my mom and dad simultaneously said to me, 3 years old, I can remember this vividly. They said, okay, but you can't do it until you graduate from school.
Good advice, eh?
Great advice, yeah. I wish they had said, you can't do it until you graduate from college, but nonetheless, I took it to heart, and I never forgot. I never, ever for a moment forgot that that's what I wanted to do and that's what I was going to do. I never had a doubt that was what I was going to do, and all during the years, in the teenage years, when I was playing guitar and singing in rock and roll bands and playing around, I never thought seriously about going into the music business, quote unquote, and becoming a recording artist. I was going to be an actor, and I worked with the LA Theater Company my last year in high school. As soon as I was out of high school, 2 weeks later, I was in New York studying and took a part-time job. It took me about 9 months, and I landed a Broadway show. And fortunately for me, as the fates would have it, one of the casting directors and a producer from what was then CBS Films saw me in this Broadway show. It wasn't a little Broadway show, but he wanted me to come out to Los Angeles to test for a film. And I said, well, I can't because I'm in the show, you know. And fortunately, the show closed, and they flew me back out to Los Angeles, where I'd spent my teenage years. I did a screen test, and from the screen test, I got Ironsides and Marcus Welby, Mod Squad, Bonanza, on and on and on and on. I did like 10 guest leads and shows. And at the end of that year, I did a pilot called, it was originally called The Family Business. And they changed it to The Partridge Family, and the rest of it, as they say, is history.
Is history. So obviously, you know, you set out to be an actor rather than a singer. But as a teenager, you must have been a great music fan. Now, you mentioned the Beatles earlier, but what were the other artists that you listened to and you admired as a teenager?
Well, I grew up in the greatest decade for me. It was the greatest decade for music. We listened to one radio station in America. We had AM radio. There was no FM radio when we were growing up. So on the same station, you'd hear the Beatles, the Stones. You could hear B.B. King. No, yeah, later. Marvin Gaye, Four Tops, Supremes, Petula Clark, Beach Boys, Tony Bennett. Need I get any wider in no. terms of the scope of the musical? And all they played was hit records, hit music. It didn't matter. From Chuck Berry to, you know, the Shirelles to who, you name it. Mm. And as a result, we were all exposed to the same music. So Black and White, when I went to shows in the 60s as a teenager, there were black artists and white artists on the same bill. They were all just hit artists. Even the 50s artists that were trying to get over, you know, and make it into the 60s, guys like Jackie Wilson, who did, and Chuck Berry and artists like that. Mm. But a lot of it changed when FM radio opened up, because it became sort of like the hip records were only played on FM and all that pop stuff was played on AM. And sadly, it became divisive, I think. And,
yeah.
And you know, I was a big Hendrix fan. I saw him 5 times. And Marvin Gaye was probably my favorite artist from that period of time, I would have to say. My favorite guitar player was by far Eric Clapton. I'd gotten all his really early stuff when he was with John Mayall and then with Cream and Blind Faith. And my friends and I, you know, would try and emulate, you know, when we were 15, 16, 17, you know, all those blues guys. And the blues, the British blues players, you know, Peter Green and Clapton and some of the real R&B based American artists had influenced them, and we were, as American kids, learning from the English guys who had gotten it from the American guys. So it was quite odd, you know. Anyway.
Well, you mentioned Marvin Gaye there. Mm. Let's play one of his songs. You've got a particular favorite.
Oh. His first hit, I think I was 12, Stubborn Kind of Fella, which I think was his very first hit. I was 12 years old, I believe, and it was one of the first records I ever bought. Say yeah.
that was Marvin Gaye and Stubborn Kind of Fella, which is chosen by my special guest today, David Cassidy. Now, David, let's move on now to the 70s, which is the time when we met, because I was comparing some of your shows when you came over here.
Yeah.
What I remember about that particular time was, I mean, I think white hot is the way to describe the audience reaction, the atmosphere at the shows, which was fantastic for the girls who were screaming, fantastic for the rest of us. But for you, one thing I remember was that you had earplugs because you just couldn't stand the sound of the screaming.
Well, when you're at the focal point of all of that, I think it becomes much more difficult, David. And I mean, you were standing on the stage and you heard it. And when you're trying to sing and play, it was such a pitch, and it never really stopped. Mm. Depending upon the venue, it was very, very, very loud, and it just helped for me to get the high end noise out of it. The wonderful thing about for me now, I've been out on tour in America, and was here last year. I'm coming back in April of 04 to probably do my very last tour of Britain. As much as I hate to say that, I'm getting on a little bit to be going all around the world and doing it. So I think, although I'm not really promoting it as the very last tour, I think it is probably going to be my last time going through the rest of the world. And my British fans have been so amazing for so long. They weren't, I wasn't doing any work over here. I hadn't been here. And when I came back a year and a half, 2 years ago, and The Then and Now album came out and was top five and platinum. Having a new CD and a tour, I think, is the right way to go. And for me, the right way to just say, God bless you, I love you, and thank you for all the great years. And, you know, I'll still be working here and there, but probably not doing extensive touring.
Do you find now that the audiences listen to you more and that actually listen to what you're singing, and do you appreciate that fact more?
Yeah, I do. They listen to it more, but I have to tell you, it's very reminiscent of the early days. And they have still an awful lot of energy and intensity. And I love that. Honestly, it's great. But they do listen to the songs, and I get them to sing them with me now, you know? I mean, they all know the words to so many of my songs. You know, Daydreamer, and it's great. It's a wonderful thing to come back. You know, I hadn't been here for over 10 years, and hadn't toured here for almost 15, I guess. And they were just so supportive, so wonderful. And very fortunate am I to have the kind of fans and have people who care about me the way they have and care about my music. And I think the latest album is a reflection of songs from me that are my favorites of all time.
Mm. I think the British fans have really obviously taken you to their hearts down the years. But just going back for a moment to the 70s, one of the things that I remember was that you had no kind of life at all, because after the show, you were spending all your time, you know, locked away in the hotel, and the girls were besieging. I mean, I remember when you came into Radio 1, I was working at Radio 1, and you came in for an interview. And we had never seen crowds like that outside Broadcasting House. They were the biggest crowds that there had ever been, and the roads were blocked. And then when you went back to your hotel, and I seem to remember one of the things that you loved doing was horse riding, and you would love to have come over here and had a chance, but there was just no chance of having any life while you were here at all.
Yeah, it wasn't just here, but you're right. It became very difficult to get in and out of a building or to do what all of us take for granted. And that was part of what, when we were talking earlier about, you know, you didn't love all of it. I mean, when it becomes where they love you so much that, you know, you can't walk out your door, it becomes a little overwhelming. And I became very reclusive as a result of it, and probably very, very shut down and hidden. And somewhat paranoid, I think, as a result, because I, you know, every possible scam had been run on to try and get to me at the time.
They were up to a few tricks, weren't they?
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
So I became very paranoid.
What are some of the outrageous things that you remember your fans doing to try and get to you?
Are you kidding? Oh, my Lord. I mean, underneath the room service trays, bribing, you know, it goes on and on and on. I can remember I did some concerts out in America, where they would bring these trailers in the day or two before in the middle of these large fairgrounds, because I was playing outdoor stadiums, and they didn't have dressing rooms. So what they would do is they'd bring these trailers where I would dress and my band would dress and all of that. And I can remember getting in it, and apparently the trailer had been there for like 2 days. And underneath the dresser, there was a makeup chair, and there was a dresser. And I heard in the cupboard these two girls giggling. And I looked under there, and there are these two filthy, dirty girls that must have been 14 or 15. It must have been 120 degrees there, and had been there for like 2 days just to meet me. And the idea of it, spending 2 days locked up in a trailer just to meet somebody, I'm sure they hadn't really prepared, but that's how they knew they could get in before they moved the trailer in off the fairgrounds. So, I mean, it goes on and on and on. Yeah. It never ends. And it was a lot of cat and mouse and a lot of trying to get, you know, wrapped up in a towel or a blanket and taken through the kitchen into the boot of a decoy car and all the rest of that.
That's right. Well, those girls are now probably married, and they've probably got a couple of kids, and they probably one day will tell their kids about what happened when they went to the David Cassidy shows.
Yeah, they bring them now. Are you kidding? Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, it's great fun. I mean, it's fantastic because they get – the kids have been exposed to it, so it's now another generation. And a lot of the – you know, when they were teenage girls in the 70s, their moms were probably pretty sick of David Cassidy. Now – I guess time heals all wounds, doesn't it, David?
That's right.
Now they come to see the shows, you know. It's like they're mums, you know. Wow, it's wild. It's very fun. The only thing I can say is instead of throwing love beads, and you know, they now throw their G's and underwear. And their voices have dropped an octave. That's all. It's pretty much the same, though.
Now, listen, we're talking about your new CD, and we want to play a track from it. So what should we play for starters?
Well, you know, I think you recall in 73 when I came over to tour and you were emceeing at Wembley. I did, because the Partridge Family and I had a big hit with Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, I did a slow version of it in which Neil Sedaka came to one of those shows and heard it and re-recorded it. And in fact, the arrangement was actually done by myself and my keyboard player at the time. Well, finally, I have re-recorded the song the way I intended to record it, the way I sang it at Wembley 30 years ago. And it's one of my favorite tracks off of it, arranged by Mike Melvoin and sung live and recorded live at Capitol, and where Sinatra and all of the greats, Nat King Cole and Sammy Davis and the rest, recorded all their stuff live, Bobby Darin. It was a wonderful experience recording the new CD, A Touch of Blue. And here's one of my favorite tracks from it, called Breaking Up Is Hard to Do.
You tell me that you're leaving. I can't believe it's true. Girl, there's just no living without you. Don't take your love away from me. Don't you leave my heart in misery. If you go, then I'll be blue. Breaking up is hard to do. Remember when you held me tight and you kissed me all through the night. Think of all that we've been through. Breaking up is hard to do. They say that breaking up is hard to do. Now I know that it's true. Don't say that this is the end. Instead of breaking up, I wish that we were making up again.
one more time. Come on, babe, let's start anew. 'Cause breaking up is hard to do. Breaking up is so very hard to do.
Well, that was David Cassidy and Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, which is a track from his new CD. And David, I'm delighted to say, is my guest in the studio today. Well, after we went our separate ways, after your tour there, David, in the 70s, tell us what happened next. Because, as you said, really, it wasn't all great. I mean, you were enormously popular at that time, but you didn't have a life. And so you went back to the States. And what was your next move?
Well, my next move was to rob a bank and then become a convict. It was difficult being on the run, I'll tell you, David. Living in trains and, God.
Well, we finally caught you.
Yes, indeed you did. No, it was a wonderful thing to be able to hang it up, because I'd worked. A lot of people don't realize that I'd spent 5 straight years working 7 days a week. I worked all day on the television show, and then after that I would go immediately over to the recording studio, and then on the weekends I would go out. So I had no personal life. Mm-hmm. And first thing I did was I kind of like went through what many people would consider kind of like a rehab, except there I wasn't doing drugs, and I wasn't drinking, and wasn't smoking, and I just was honestly very emotionally burnt out. Mm-hmm. And I spent the first 6 months really not even leaving my house, and I had a large estate, and friends of mine would come over and we'd start to play a little bit, and I was a little depressed. I think I was clinically probably a little depressed, because I felt like, okay, that's over, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, so I just began writing and playing. It took me about 6 months to a year, and I wrote and recorded an album. I had no intention of coming back and touring again and supporting it, but wrote some good songs and met some great musicians and played along the way that Mick Ronson, and who had been with Bowie for a while, and I hooked up, and I made a couple of albums for RCA, and they did very, very well internationally, all over the world. They were platinum albums, but I really had lost the motivation to go out and work, and I think it wasn't until I got back and did a movie for television, a police story called A Chance to Live, I got nominated for an Emmy for, that I felt any kind of desire to go back and really apply myself to my career again, and that took a couple of years. So the recording end of my life really ended in like 76. Mm. I think that was the last time I felt a desire and a passion for going in the studio and just not doing it for the sake of doing it to sell records, but to do it because I wanted to do something, because I had something to say, or there were songs I really wanted to record. And through the writing and meeting my co-writer, Sue Schifrin, and getting back into it, wasn't until like until the mid-80s, Alan Tarney and I worked together, and it was 84. I came over to the UK and recorded an album for Arista that became, we co-wrote almost the whole album together. Had a big hit with Last Kiss. And I think that really started to bring me back. And from there, I went into the theater and did a lot of work in the West End, doing Time and Blood Brothers in America, and on and on and on and on. But working with Alan Tarney, who had worked a lot with Cliff and had written a lot of hits. Oh. He and I worked together. I think that was the thing musically that really brought me back.
I think it'd be great to hear that record again. It was a great record.
Yeah, it was.
Let's hear David and The Last Kiss. David Cassidy, my special guest in the studio today. Great to see him again after such a long time.
And you.
Yes. Well, we did have some fun back in those days.
Indeed we did, my friend, when we could get away with it then.
Exactly. In between all the screaming.
Yeah.
So we got up to the last kiss. What I'm sort of gathering from the story so far is that you had an enormous kind of gear change. What you did was you stood back, you had a good think about it, and you thought, this is where my career is going to go now, and it's going to go now in a different direction.
Mm. Well, I felt like I didn't want to try and compete with my former success and fame. And, you know, David Cassidy and the character I created on The Partridge Family was, you know, like a chapter in the book. And I think the most important and most significant thing is that you have to understand that it's about, for me, it's been always been about the work. And if the work is good, the fame and the money and all the rest of it come, the success come. So if you write good songs. If you act well, no matter what you do. And I began writing and and having people record my material and songs. And I think, interestingly enough, the role that changed it significantly for me was playing the role of Mickey on Broadway in Blood Brothers, and the kind of success we had. I mean, I was on the cover of People magazine from being on in the theater on Broadway, and that just doesn't happen. I don't think anyone else has ever been. Usually it's movies and television and, you know, or something dramatic. But we had done something so dramatic, and as Bill Kenwright, the infamous British producer, said, it's never happened before in the history of Broadway. And we turned the show around so dramatically, and I think critically it was fantastic for me. And from there I went on, and they asked me to come in and fix Michael Crawford, had gone out of this EFX show in Vegas, and it was dying. So I went in and completely redid that, and became a very, very successful show, and went on to produce a television series and a movie, and also write and produce a show called The Rat Pack Is Back, which has become a huge hit in America for me, and then doing At the Copa for a year. So I'm spanning years worth of work, but it's the body of the work, all of the work. If it's good, you know, the rest of it, the success and everything else comes. And I never wanted to go back and try and recreate something. I just wanted people to know I loved it and embraced it. And the fact that I had the kind of success I had, we wrote some good songs and we recorded some great records in the 70s. And I sing a lot of them now. You know, my last tour, I went and asked all the fans on my website at davidcassidy.com, what do you want me to record? What do you want me to sing? What do you want me to play live? So they made up a good part of the set, and probably for the last tour I do in Britain, I'm going to do the same.
Let's just have a little break for music now. And you mentioned the Rat Pack there, and I thought maybe we might play something by one of the artists from the Rat Pack. What do you fancy?
Kick in the Head is a great song that Dean does.
Oh, yeah. How did I think you were going to say Dean Martin? I just somehow thought you were. Here he is, Dino, and ain't that a kick in the head?
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? The room was completely black. I hugged her and she hugged back. Like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in a boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. I've sunshine enough to spread. It's just like the fella said. Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head? Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? Like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in a boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. She's telling me we'll be wed. She's picked out a king-size bed. I couldn't feel any better, or I'd be sick. Tell me quick, oh, ain't love a kick? Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head?
That was Dean Martin. And ain't that a kick in the head? Did you see him work, David?
Oh, yeah. I knew him because of his, you know, his son's going to my school. It was a small school, and it was called Beverly Hills Adjacent. It wasn't actually in Beverly Hills, but close. This is when I was living in L.A. as a teenager, obviously, and Dean came to a couple of the events at the school. But, I got to know him a little later on. My stepmother, after I became really successful, my stepmom did the Dean Martin show, which for years was a top 10 show in America.
Mm.
And, he was a legendary kind of a figure.
Well, we're running very short of time. I mean, we could chat all day. But just to come up to date, haven't you got a son who is showing a keen interest in the business?
I have. His name is Beau, but he, like what my father and mother said to me in the back of the cab when I was 3 years old, I've said to him as a mantra, after you graduate from college, anything you want to do, I'll be there to help you. I'll manage you. I'll do whatever you want me to do. Mm. He's got a gift, though. He's very, very talented. And he's a wonderful guy. He's got a very sweet nature, and he's perhaps a little too sweet. He's not tough in that way. He has great compassion for other people, and it's what I love about him. He's a wonderful person, and he's very bright. He's a straight-A student in school and a great athlete, and has played from baseball to soccer to... now he's on the golf team. And I love the fact that he's into athletics as much as he is. I was a good athlete in school, but he's even better than I was. And I think he's a better singer than I was at the time, too. And musically, he's just gifted, I think.
This is deja vu, isn't it, really? Because here you're saying to him, when you get through college instead of school. Interesting, that point, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
When you get through college,
yeah. I'll do whatever you want me to do, but I want you to be prepared. He wants to be an actor. I think he wants to go to NYU. He's going to come with me for a little bit of the tour when I start in April. And if I can just tell you that we're going to start the tour on April the 24th in Glasgow, and we finish up, I think it's somewhere around... May, the middle of May, after we do Hammersmith Apollo on the 6th and 7th of May. But there are a bunch of dates. I think we got 10 or 12 dates here. And I just want to say to you, it's great to see you again and to be a part of this with you again some 30 years later. And to still be doing it, you're doing what you do, and I've got a new CD out, and I'm still doing what I do, and I love to do it, and I'm just happy that we're able to connect and that we're still here together.
Absolutely. The boys are still here. We're still doing it. And we want to wish you, David, good luck with the tour in the new year and also with the new CD. And we'd like to finish with another track from that. So
yeah.
What's it going to be?
Well, one of my favorite songs that I've ever written is called New York City Life. And it's really about your life changing and about finding a place for yourself that you feel grounded and you feel at home in. And a lot of it for me, my wife says it's the best song I've ever written. I don't know about that, but it's one of my favorite songs I've ever written. So it's off the new Touch of Blue album called New York City Life.
David Cassidy, thank you very much, and we'll see you again before 30 years.
Let's hope so, David.
Seems impossible to me how California just don't fall into the sea. See, they got so many people there, they even got that smoggy air. What's the use in me flying out when we both know what that's about? And it's foolish just to take a trip. Besides, I don't belong on Sunset Strip. My life in LA, it seems so passé. Even if they made me king, wouldn't stay another day. Now I'll never, ever are gonna go back where the ground beneath my feet's gonna crack. Why the hell would I wanna do that when I got my New York City of pretty actresses who'll never see Broadway. They'll never